What should we make of the Justice Department's unusual decision to try to dismiss the charges against Michael Flynn? And what is this Obamagate stuff that Trump keeps talking about? Let's get on topic. Welcome to On Topic, a weekly in-depth look at a topic that helps us understand the week's news. My name's Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a legal analyst. And I'm joined by my friend Patty Vasquez, the host of The Patty Vasquez Show, who joins us regularly on this podcast. Now, before I thank our patrons, I do want to note I did not mention the word CNN in the intro, and that's because my contract with CNN is up. So a number of you noticed and reached out to me that you saw me on MSNBC this week, and I suspect I'll end up being on MSNBC more in the weeks to come. But for right now, I'll still be doing the same thing I'm doing, but I'm just doing it on multiple networks. So before I get to our episode and our discussion with Patty, let me thank our patrons who brought us this episode, with special thanks to Michelle Dew, Eric DeWurst, James Frohmeyer, Jay Gelhausen, Jamie Gordon, Steve Hungsberg, Shana Wachinski, and an anonymous patron. You too can become a patron on our website, ontopicpodcast.com. Just click the support link at the top of the page. Well, Patty, it has been quite a week. I have to say, for a period of time, it really looked like the legal issues surrounding Trump were taking a backstage to coronavirus and COVID-19 and this entire pandemic. And now suddenly people are talking once again about the assault on the rule of law. And now Trump has sort of cooked up his own conspiracy theory to try to distract the media from his own failings in terms of dealing with the pandemic.
Yeah, he really found an interesting way to spend Mother's Day, didn't he? no heartfelt messages. It could have been 156 tweets about mothers and celebrating families, but no, it was sheer madness on Sunday.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. Trump is on the warpath. And I will say this. I mean, I think he is, very effective at dominating the news cycle, distracting our attention away from what matters. You know, and there's no question that his response to the pandemic has been poor. And I think that is reflected in the poll numbers. And so now he keeps saying Obamagate, Obamagate. And it's really sort of a catchy name in search of an actual scandal. I mean, there's no, when he was asked what crime is he accusing President Obama of committing, Trump couldn't come up with one. And he really, I don't think, has any idea of any actual crime or wrongdoing here. It's just sort of a vague innuendo, but it's enough to, I think, have gotten his face pretty riled up.
Well, and looking back now, I mean, I'm not sure how you feel about it, but it seemed like he was starting to find ways to point fingers at Obama. Like, he wanted to make Obama in some ways negative, and perhaps it's because Joe Biden is now the candidate, and obviously Obama will be campaigning with him, trying to undermine their, that incredible amount of popularity he has by first saying it was his fault that they didn't leave him a plan book for a pandemic, which, of course, that was proven to be false, that it was, so many things that were his fault, and then ultimately on Sunday, just a spiraling before our very eyes on Twitter.
Yeah, I think, whatever different attacks he's made on Biden really haven't stuck. He keeps calling him Sleepy Joe Biden. I'm not sure people are most worried about having a president who's sleepy or not hyper aggressive at this point in time. I think they'd be happy to have a president who isn't tweeting 100 times a day.
We'd rather have a president that leads. We need a national plan. Well, we needed one back in January, February, March, last week. But we're not going to have that for this pandemic.
Well, I think that's right. And, Biden doesn't have, in terms of legal problems, he doesn't have the sort of issue that, Hillary Clinton's the email issue that was raised during the last campaign was very much blown out of proportion. It was something that I think, as James Comey said at the time, no prosecutor would have prosecuted because there really had never been a prosecution in a case like that before, but it generated a ton of media attention. Now I think, you know, Trump sees a void here. He needs some sort of legal problem to play out. And, you know, what I will say is he's essentially found a way to manufacture one. The Republicans seem to be marching along with this. Lindsey Graham said he's having a bunch of hearings, and it appears to be that what's happened is because of this Michael Flynn story that is unfolded, which we're going to be talking about in detail today with our guest, you know, what they've essentially tried, I think, hinted at, but they don't allege because there's nothing, I think there's no meat to it. There's nothing there that the origins of the Russia investigation were false, that Michael Flynn was set up, and that this is all a grand conspiracy by Barack Obama. I mean, that's essentially, as far as I can tell, what the allegations are. There's really no evidence to suggest those things. But it is definitely, I think, a good distracting tactic. It certainly managed to change the conversation for at least the short term.
Oh, no doubt.
All right. Well, let's bring in our guest. Ken White is a former federal prosecutor. He also is a practitioner who regularly represents individuals who are accused of crimes. And he's a regular contributor to The Atlantic. But you probably know him best as Pope Hat. He is a blogger and also a tweeter under that name. And he's a frequent commentator. And I will just say to all of you, the reason I'm bringing him on is I think he provides a very interesting and balanced perspective on this issue of the Michael Flynn case. I know a lot of you have questions. We've got an insane number of questions and comments and inquiries, which Patty's going to do her best to bring to our attention today. But I think Ken is somebody who can help us kind of have a balanced perspective as somebody who's been on both sides of the issue, just as I have, both as a federal prosecutor and now as a practicing lawyer. Welcome back to the podcast, Ken. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me again.
So, you know, Ken, I have to say, this has been really a set of shocking developments. I was very surprised, to put it mildly, to read the government's motion, the DOJ's motion to dismiss the charges against Flynn. You know, you had remarked, I think, on Twitter that it read like a bad defense brief. And I think that's about right. I mean, it reads like a lot of the things that you or I might write on behalf of clients that are routinely opposed by the DOJ and rejected by courts. And then, of course, we had this even more shocking development yesterday in terms of the appointment of an amicus. You know, I'm curious, what was your reaction to that DOJ motion?
Well, I thought it was quite shocking. It was like defense lawyers' Hail Mary pass. It was a collection of quibbles and complaints about the way the FBI conducts interviews, about what materiality is or isn't, a series of arguments that have been repeatedly and roundly rejected by every court to consider them. And it's routinely, as you said, opposed by the Justice Department. So to me, it was just so transparently in bad faith for the Justice Department to be making arguments that it so routinely opposes and rejects.
Yeah, I think it'll be helpful for us to give the listener some context here. Okay, so, you know, I was a prosecutor for almost a decade. I know you were a prosecutor for many years, federal prosecutor in the Central District of California, which is the district that includes L.A. I was a prosecutor in the district that includes Chicago. Both of our districts, you know, prosecuted people for violating the statute, the 18 U.S.C. 1001, which is lying to the FBI. And now we've represented people on the other side. And I have to say, you know, these charges have, I'd say, a set of case law that I think a lot of average people would regard as unfair. In other words, you know, the FBI is allowed to lie to people. They're allowed to trick people in the course of an interview. I've had clients lied to, and I've had the jury instructed that the FBI lied to the defendant, and that's okay. That's permitted in the law. And yet, nonetheless, they can be prosecuted. The defendant can be prosecuted for making false statements to the FBI. even in circumstances in which it looked like the only purpose of the interview was potentially to get them to lie.
Yes, it's true. You know, a lot of people use the term perjury trap, and it has a specific legal meaning. There is such a thing if it's a perjury trap, and it's when they call you to the grand jury just to get you to perjure yourself so they can prosecute you. But I think people have a sort of a sense of justice about it that colloquially it's a perjury trap for the agents to know a fact 100% and go after you to ask you questions about it, hoping that you'll lie so that they can then charge you, even if the lie didn't slow them down or confuse them or deter them for a second. That really seems like manufacturing a crime out of human foibles.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people find that surprising. But in fact, I mean, I will say in my former office, we prosecuted Rod Blagojevich, who was the governor, for making false statements to the FBI agents. He was convicted. Dennis Hastert, the former Speaker of the House. You know, those questions that they were asked were not a surprise. The answers were not a surprise to the FBI because, you know, for example, in the case of Dennis Hastert, you know, he was asked about why he was making withdrawals from a bank account. And the withdrawals were to pay off an accuser who had accused him of molesting him when he was underage. And the FBI knew that. But, you know, those questions, I don't have any special knowledge about that particular case. I wasn't involved in it. But it was apparent that the FBI knew that there was a good chance Hastert was going to lie, and he was prosecuted for lying. And, you know, this happens in other cases. And so I think, you know, everyone should understand that from Michael Flynn, from my perspective, and I would be interested if you disagree, from my perspective, Ken, the Flynn case is not even an outlier. I mean, it's not one of these crazy outside the box cases. This is, to me, much more straight down the middle than a lot of other 1001 cases that have been prosecuted.
Oh, it's very routine, mundane. You know, they knew some facts. They had irrefutable proof. They went in thinking either we'll get him to admit this or he'll lie, and then we'll have that in our quiver as a potential felony charge. And, you know, either way, we win. And that's the way they do it all the time. And then they use that 1001 charge to leverage other things. So it changes the defense's calculation about whether or not to fight more substantive charges, more serious charges. Because if you figure, you know, I might beat the big charge, I might beat the Foreign Agent Registration Act charge, but I'm dead on this 1001 charge, so I'm going to get convicted of a felony no matter what. All of a sudden, you're much more likely to plead guilty because there's not much point in doing anything else.
Yeah, I have seen... you know, I have seen both when I was a federal prosecutor and on the other side, very aggressive use of this statute. Sometimes, of course, in circumstances that I think many people would applaud. I think a lot of people applauded the Dennis Hastert prosecution, even though his molestation and abuse of underage men was not a federal crime and was past the statute of limitations. That was nonetheless, I think, very widely praised. But there are other circumstances in which I think, you know, the defendants, you know, believe and they have good reasons to believe that the treatment has not always been fair. But nonetheless, this is the standard. And so, you know, to give some color on some of the unusual positions taken by the government, I noticed that you had mentioned, Ken, you had pointed to where they were talking about having a lawyer present. Where they were talking about whether or not a warning was issued. Can you give us some context about those things?
Yes. I mean, the FBI is exquisitely trained in doing interviews. They're really quite good at it. And there are elements of that training that are designed to get people to say things against their better judgment. There are also elements that arguably make it easier for the FBI to shade the truth about what happened. For instance, they don't record these interviews. It's a policy not to record them, which in my mind is highly questionable. But they absolutely want to convince you against your interest that you don't need to talk to a lawyer, that you can talk to them now and not think about it for a while, that they're on your side. You know, every sort of transparently cheesy trick you see in a cop show in TV or a Columbo rerun, they use extremely skillfully. So when the brief said all these things about how, you know, in deciding this wasn't a just prosecution, we saw that, you know, they discouraged him from getting a lawyer and they contrived to talk to him outside of normal channels so he wouldn't have that protection. I mean, like, of course they did. That's what they do. That's the way they conduct these interviews, so that they can get people to say things that are against their interests. And for the Department of Justice to pretend for a moment that they actually disapprove of those things, that that's actually something unjust, to me is incredibly dishonest, because they've never said it before and they're never going to say it again. This is a one-time deal that this bothers their conscience, and it's because it was done to a political crony. And they're going to go right back to doing it. And, you know, you and I are going to quote this thing in motions to suppress statements and in sentencing briefs. And everyone's going to know that it's for show, that, you know, the fix was in and they didn't really mean that. And that's why it's not going to have any persuasive power.
Yeah, I think that's right. It reminds me of where there's these tweets that Trump says all sorts of things at the courts. Now there's all these cases out there that say, the president doesn't mean what he says, or we can't trust anything he said, doesn't mean anything. It doesn't bind the government. I think this is sort of a one off case in which, you know, there have been other people put into prison for very similar circumstances, but this guy gets a special deal. And the Justice Department, I imagine, is going to pretend like this didn't happen, because I have literally sat in the courtroom as, you know, defendants were testifying and complaining about how they were tricked. You know, they thought that this was, you know, I remember one deputy U.S. Marshal who was convicted of crimes, who was convinced that he had a special project and he needed to come into this room, and suddenly all of his coworkers, but also FBI agents, were questioning him about activities, and they later prosecuted him. And, you know, he thought that was unfair, but the law didn't, the judge didn't, and he's in prison. So definitely, I think it's very hard for me to escape the conclusion here, Ken, that this is one system of justice for the president's friends and another system of justice for everybody else.
And it's true. And I think it would have been in some ways less harmful to the interests of justice substantially for Trump to simply have pardoned him. I mean, that's clearly within Trump's power. We might not like it politically, but to do this very much perverts perverts the course of justice. And that's upsetting to me.
Yeah, I think one thing that's been interesting too, Ken, is to see the reaction from people on the right from this. And what is interesting is, first of all, I think we're seeing a lot of people saying, you know, condemning practices that we know are widespread and have been defended by the Justice Department, saying, well, this can't be how the system works. Or, you know, I remember Kim Strassel was saying, if this is how things, you know, prosecutors are saying this, or people are saying this is routine, but if it's just routine, this is really problematic. But I don't think any of us really believe that these people are interested in reforming the system in a way that helps other types of defendants, right?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's not going to happen. It's the same with, you know, all the talk about FISA and the FISA warrants that started off some of this story. There's big talk about we got to stop this happening to Americans. And, you know, recently all the FISA gets reauthorized and the proposed amendments to narrow it or prevent abuses are refused, rejected.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at this motion. I mean, ultimately, it's interesting what the DOJ is saying here. They don't admit or say that they engage in any misconduct. There's no statement here that the DOJ did anything wrong. They're not saying that the defendant is actually innocent. In other words, he didn't lie, which would be very hard because, of course, he said under oath multiple times to this judge that he did lie, so to the FBI. So I don't think that they would be able to say that. So essentially, you know, they're ultimately saying that it's not in the interest of justice to pursue this prosecution. And really, it's, you know, usually a judge would defer to the DOJ's mercy in a case like this, or just use of its discretion, especially since the defendant doesn't oppose it. And here, of course, there's been a different posture by the judge. You know, I'm curious what your reaction is to that.
You know, I think it's a real conundrum for the judge. On the one hand, you have a separation of powers issue. It should clearly be the executive that's making the decision about whom to prosecute and how to proceed with that prosecution within the rules, and generally whether to drop a prosecution. And the U.S. Attorney's offices have always very jealously guarded that. And I'm sure, Renata, you, like I did once in a while, encountered a federal judge who thought that they should be able to tell us how things should be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. And it was very much our job to push back. On the other hand, I mean, the federal rules do give the judge the right to deny or grant this motion to dismiss. And when things have happened in front of that judge, it's within their inherent authority to investigate whether anyone has perjured themselves, whether anyone has committed misconduct. And when, you know, you've got a Justice Department filing a historically unusual, not to say freakish, document that's nothing like this judge has ever seen, dramatically changing their position, and prosecutors who are associated with the case are dropping out, then I can see the judge deciding that he wants to make this decision fully informed, and he feels that he's not being fully informed, that he's got the defense side and then he's got the friends of the defense side with the government. And he wants somebody to, in effect, speak the side of the prosecutors who indicted the case and who negotiated the plea agreement.
Well, you know, that I can see the wisdom in that as well. I mean, for instance, there has been some uproar because Judge Gleason, who I had appeared for before when I was a young lawyer, I thought he was very capable, able judge, who happened to have also been a federal prosecutor for many years in Brooklyn. I think he had secured the Gotti conviction, which is a very celebrated case. And you know, there's been a lot made on the right from the fact that he's penned an op-ed explaining that he thinks this is problematic what the Justice Department is doing. And I guess that doesn't bother me so much, because the purpose here is for him to present the other side. It also ultimately is the judge's decision.
Right. I mean, because the judge, we don't have an inquisitorial system, right? Like in some countries where the judge conducts their own inquisition into the facts. We have a system where the facts are supposed to be presented by advocates. But if the judge thinks that one advocate is basically deliberately taking a dive, then you could see why the judge, before making the decision, would like to have in some substitute to give that sort of thing. And I think the judge probably correctly feels that the factual recitation in the government's motion is not accurate. And by all accounts, it really isn't. It misrepresents some of the things that happened. It misinterprets the words of some of the people quoted who have come out and said so. And I don't think it's unreasonable for the judge to want to make the decision based on facts that have not been misrepresented by the Department of Justice.
Yeah, I have to say, it's astounding to me. I mean, when I was in the Justice Department, there was a very high premium spent on being very accurate to judges, because the DOJ is very much a repeat player in front of those judges. If you're at a U.S. attorney's office in a particular district, you're going to see those same federal judges over and over and over again. And the reputation of the office, I was always taught, was more than any individual person. So accuracy was hyper important. And here we have the Justice Department quoting Mary McCord, former DOJ official. And she wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post saying, my words were misrepresented. I thought that was astonishing.
Yeah, and I think that is probably part of what is really vexing the judge. He's shown very strong feelings about this case in the past, of course. He read Flynn the Riot Act when he was previously just flirting with withdrawing his plea instead of doing it. He very publicly forced him into renewing his vows, as it were. He said that he was asking why Flynn wasn't charged with treason, which I actually thought was a little over the line.
I agree.
As a judicial comment, particularly since it's nothing like treason. And, you
correct.
Know,
totally
we both know that treason has a very specific constitutionally defined meaning. People misuse it all the time. It irritates you and me. and that was a judge being intemperate moment. This is just the type of judge who, if he hears that the Justice Department has fed him a line that is misleading, is going to want to inquire into it. And, I've seen that happen, not on this scale, not with this level of, cinematic excitement. But I have seen judges, when they feel they have been lied to, take the bit in their mouth and run with it to find out what happened.
Yeah, I have also seen in situations where the government, there's an administration change and the government is no longer defending a particular position in a suit. I've seen courts appoint lawyers to represent the prior position if there's, some reason to do so. I've seen that happen. And I remember in other contexts, of course, a special master being appointed. I was a research assistant to the special master in the Microsoft antitrust case back when I was in law school. So it certainly happens. There's been a lot of uproar on the right, basically saying we don't want amicus briefs. We don't want this particular amicus. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's 50% not wanting to see what comes out of it, and 50% just pushing the narrative forward that we've got to criticize the amicus briefs because we've got to push the narrative that this is a deep state judge and, Trump is being abused and Flynn is being abused and blah, blah, blah. Where in reality, if what you're doing is getting more facts on the record, that should be a good thing. If it's testing what the United States is saying to this judge, I think the real thing where it becomes a problem is what the judge does on the ruling. And I think, frankly, there's some people have been arguing that the judge doesn't actually have the ability to deny the motion to dismiss. I don't think that's right. I think that at best there's a cloudy legal argument in that direction, but I do think it would be very problematical in terms of separation of powers for the judge to deny the motion. But what the judge may want to do is grant it without prejudice and to do so with some sort of critique of how they got there that lays out the issues and makes it clear that he is not doing it because he has been fooled by what amounts to a very dishonest Department of Justice brief.
Yeah, I think that that's a very likely outcome. And so what this means is, and I would say likely outcome, but it appears like a very plausible outcome here. I don't want to predict what the judge is going to do because who knows what's going on in his head. But it sure seems to me like what we're looking at here is potentially Judge Sullivan laying out, asking very tough questions of the DOJ, which they're not going to be very well prepared to answer. Okay. I think some of the questions I could craft a whole number of questions for the DOJ that they would be very uncomfortable answering. And I'm sure he will, ask some of those potentially. And then at the end, giving his thoughts on it, but nonetheless granting the motion. But as you said, if he grants it without prejudice, that means that a future administration could reinstate the charges. And potentially mean that if Trump wants to ensure that Flynn gets off, that he's going to have to pardon.
Sure. I mean, an example of what we could see, I think, is a little bit like what Judge Amy Berman Jackson, or long-suffering Judge Amy Berman Jackson, as we call her on our show, listened to Roger Stone's motion for a new trial based on alleged juror misconduct. She kind of gave them what they asked for, and it didn't turn out well. She did an extremely thorough inquiry and hearing that wound up creating a very strong appellate record in favor of denying the motion, and that also really made Stone's lawyers look terrible for completely failing to do any sort of jury inquiry at all during the process. So what could wind up from the government's motion is that they win in part, they get dismissal without prejudice, but as part of that, they get a very thorough examination of their motives and of the truthfulness of their representations.
Yeah, I could see that happening. And of course, that could potentially have consequences for some of those attorneys with the bar and so forth. But I think realistically, it's more the reputation of the DOJ that is at stake there. And it's, you know, it is going, you know, it's certainly taken a hit here. I mean, I've noticed, Ken, we have this recent news about Senator Burr having his cell phone seized and searched, which seems to me like that would be a reasonable thing to do in a insider trading investigation. And then there's people saying, oh, this is political retaliation by Trump or Barr or whatever. And really, it, you know, it's hard to call those sorts of speculation in questions to be unreasonable, given what's happened here with Michael Flynn.
You're right. 2 years ago, if you had said, you know, Barr's getting his phone searched, it's clearly a political retaliation, I would have dismissed it as obviously ridiculous. A year ago, I still would have said, I think that's unlikely. You know, I don't think that's the way it's going to work. Right now, I cannot make that representation to you. I no longer have belief that this Justice Department under this leadership would shy away from that sort of overtly political machination.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. I certainly have no trust and don't put any credence in what Barr is doing. I'd like to believe that this is just a straight up prosecution, but who knows? I will say we have gotten a lot of questions from listeners about the, I guess, what's going to happen going forward regarding the Mikas. You know, Patty, do you have a question for us?
Yeah, well, it was, I think part of the answer was, and part of your conversation, because they wanted, they're asking very nicely. They say, please address the amicus brief and what that might look like. And they say thank you ahead in advance. And they also ask, what kind of timeline can be expected if 2,000 plus can make arguments? How will this work?
So I'll answer the second part because that's an important one. Is people can file briefs with the court giving their views, and a lot of people will. I know some are in the works. But they're not going to actually make oral arguments. They're just going to submit their views in writing so the judge can read the ones he wants to, not read the ones he doesn't want to, and he can basically just use them to inform his views. I'm curious, what do you think we can expect from Judge Gleason acting as the amicus, Ken?
Well, I have to think that Judge Sullivan chose Judge Gleason for a reason. Knowing what he's like, knowing his background, the types of cases he's done in the past, and his personality. And so because of that, I expect Judge Gleason to ask for the amount of time necessary to do a thorough job. And I really expect him to ultimately take apart the brief that DOJ filed, and his ultimate opinion, his ultimate recommendation may be, you know, because of the separation of powers, you should do this. But I suspect to the extent he thinks that that brief is dishonest and misleading, that it has false recitations of history, that he's going to say so. And that's going to be on the record.
Yeah, I'm curious. One thing that I found very bizarre in Judge Sullivan's order was his suggestion about criminal contempt for perjury. And I'm curious, What exactly do you think he's getting at there? I mean, do you really think that he's going to potentially find that Michael Flynn committed perjury in his courtroom?
I mean, I guess he could. I don't think he should. You know, for the listeners, what likely he's talking about is this. When you enter a guilty plea, you go through a guilty plea discussion with the judge. It's called a colloquy. And at the beginning of it, you're placed under oath and told that if you lie in answer to any of these questions, you could be prosecuted for perjury. It's actually vanishingly rare for that to happen. And the plea colloquy, depending on the judge, can go on for 15 minutes or 45 minutes while they explain your rights and make sure you understand them. So Flynn, twice under oath, because remember, Judge Sullivan got him basically to reaffirm, said that he had done these things and he was guilty. So what Sullivan seems to be saying is that, well, you know, somewhere there's a lie. Either you lied when you said you were guilty, or you're lying now and the government's lying now saying you're not guilty. I understand where he's going with that. I understand his frustration. I don't think it's a fair or just approach for him to take. The truth is, and Renato, I bet you know this too, is that defendants frequently lie about something or other in a plea colloquy in order to get a plea. Sometimes it's because the government is convinced of 10 facts that they want you to admit, and 8 of them are accurate. The other 2 aren't accurate, but the government's insisting you admit them. They don't make any difference, so you admit them, even though they're not true. Sometimes you admit you're guilty when you're not. That does happen because the plea is still a rational way out of the situation. And I think it's an abuse of the court's power and the government's power to say, well, you know, we got you in this position where all you could do is plea, and now we're going to prosecute you if the government decides to dismiss the case and not go forward with that plea. I think that's misunderstanding who the bad person is in this scenario. Is Flynn a bad person? Yes, I think he is. But the Department of Justice pulling this scam is the real bad person in this particular motion scenario.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I agree that with you in part. I mean, I agree that this is not the move I think Judge Sullivan should have made. I don't think he should have put this out there. I actually thought perhaps he was doing it in part to kind of shake up the parties a little bit and make the Flynn side realize that, you know, hey, we need to be a little less aggressive here because there's still potential downside for us, and to potentially suggest that, hey, you know, I have this power to do things on my own, which, you know, usually prosecutions are done by the executive branch, you know, and he's recognizing and mentioning, of course, that things that happen in front of him in his courtroom, he can essentially handle on his own. And that's true. But yeah, I think for me, the what's problematical about it is, you know, in part, I think what Flynn would say is if any of these statements are true or false, that it was based upon his understanding of the facts and the law at the time, that he didn't understand that these vague arguments about materiality, and I suppose we should talk a little bit about those, that are being made by the DOJ. And now that he understands that the facts and law are different than he understood them, as, you know, get told to him by Covington and Burling, he has a different view on the matter. And he wasn't trying to lie before, but he was following his counsel's advice then. And he thought that that was right. And now he thinks it's wrong. And I don't see how that sort of how you could uphold or sustain a conviction along those lines.
Yeah, I don't.
That's sort of my view.
I don't see how you lie about whether or not something is material because it's a purely legal question. And as this ridiculous Department of Justice brief shows, you could articulate extremely different views on it. But Renato, I think you might have hit on something there that the perjury part may be a bit of a judicial flourish, a bit of bluster, which we have both been on the receiving end of before.
Yep.
You know, I remember the judge I clerked for, who was a very kindly and decent man. Nevertheless, once when someone's very early primitive cell phone went off in his courtroom, said, if that happens again, you're leaving here in leg irons. Now, he probably would not actually have made the marshals find leg irons and probably wouldn't have had the person arrested. But, you know, judges say stuff like that sometimes to, in effect, emphasize how upset they are.
Yeah. And I've seen judges suggest contempt before just to kind of get people's attention. OK. And I think, you know, Flynn's lawyers, you know, just so everyone understands the context, you know, Flynn's prior law firm in the matter that got him the deal with Mueller's office that in which he pled guilty was Covington and Burling, very respected, well-known large law firm. And, you know, he now has a lawyer who's sort of part of the MAGA group or whatever, who is more about the press and making headlines and is kind of played fast and loose at times with the facts, in the case. And so I think, you know, part of it is, you know, potentially the judge trying to signal to her that, hey, there's potential consequences here for your client. You need to take this seriously. This isn't just going to be a press conference for you.
Yes, I think that's very much true.
Yeah, I do think it's worth just quickly explaining this point about materiality. All that materiality is it's a requirement that the false statement be something that's capable of influencing the FBI, not that it actually does. So in other words, as you were alluding to in the beginning, Ken, that the FBI could know that you're lying to them at the very moment you're lying to them. But if it was capable of influencing them, in some alternative universe, I suspect, where they didn't know that this was false, then that's enough. And essentially, the argument by DOJ is, well, this wasn't a proper investigation, so it couldn't have influenced anything because he really wasn't being investigated for anything appropriate at that time anyway.
I have literally never even seen or read a defense lawyer argument that aggressive about materiality. It is beyond the pale. It is absolutely, you know, the language is whether it's a matter in the jurisdiction. Clearly looking into this is a matter in the jurisdiction. It doesn't matter whether they were planning on closing it but hadn't. It doesn't matter whether or not it, you know, eventually played out. It's absolutely clear that by all the case law currently, it was material. And I mean, the case law is quite frankly very vexing. I think it's unfair that it's still material, even if they know that you're lying and it doesn't slow them down for a minute. Well, and one of the ways you know how unfair it is how they treat government lies differently. So, Renato, as you know, if the cops or the FBI lie in a search warrant application to search your house, or lie in an arrest warrant application or something like that, the defendant, to get relief, has to show that the lie was material. But then all of a sudden it means something different. When the FBI lies in a search warrant application, material has to mean it changed the outcome. So you have to show that but for the lie, they wouldn't have gotten the search warrant. So it is a much more robust of materiality than the type we're talking about here. Because again, we treat people, citizens, mere mortals, differently than we treat law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's safe to say, I would put it this way, that a lot of these bodies of law were developed in cases in which judges really did not want to suppress evidence that would result in a case being dismissed and the defendant released. They felt, you know, often I think there's a situation where a judge potentially in a particular case doesn't want to have a scenario where somebody who's done something wrongful is out on the street. And as a result, you get, I'd say, very permissive and aggressive case law that allows the government to do things at times that can be outrageous. I mean, I did see, you know, I was talking on Twitter about this, talking about how the government lies to people. And Brad Heath from and I think he used to be at USA Today. I think he's at Bloomberg or AP or something now, mentioned, you know, cases in which the DEA had hired prostitutes to lure people to buy drugs. I mean, and that was considered not problematic for those prosecutions. So there's definitely a lot of conduct that most people would think is pretty unfair that is permitted by judges. And I think that my gut is that what's animating that is judges not wanting to quote, set somebody free.
To me, the disturbing thing here is that this is causing us to talk about some fundamental things about the fairness of the system and the appropriateness of law enforcement tactics. And because of that, I would like those discussions to go on. I would like them to yield something. But I think they've been completely cynically taken over, not for the actual result of a change to the system, but just to justify this one particular corrupt act. And I don't think there's any chance that any of these systemic problems we're talking about are going to be changed as a result of this for other people who aren't buddies with the person in power.
Yeah, I have to say, for me, I mean, one of the things that's just unbelievable, I have trouble believing, is how this is morphed into, on the right, Obamagate, and there's some sort of grand conspiracy in which this is turned into, you know, Flynn was, quote, framed. I don't know how they've gotten to that. Here's a guy who's admitted under oath multiple times that he's guilty. And that somehow President Obama set everyone up. I don't even understand what the allegation means.
I mean, if I ask my kid if they ate the last of the cookie dough, I know they're going to lie. That doesn't mean I framed them. It's not what it means. You can not admire the tactics and not think that a lie like that should result in a federal felony and still recognize it as a lie from somebody who maybe should not have that position of power. I just think that we are not dwelling in the same universes, factually. We have two completely different set of ideas about what's happening and the significance of it. And it's very rare for any of our insights about the way the system actually works to penetrate the brain of advocates on either side.
You know, I agree. I mean, I have to say that, you know, the narrative here just is, it's hard for me to follow. I don't even really understand what the allegations are. I've been trying to follow. I actually follow a lot of right wingers on Twitter to try to see what their thoughts are on this. And it's just hard for me to even follow. But I think it seems to be part of a strategy to create the 2020 version of Hillary's emails. So we've got some sort of, you know, trumped up scandal where it's, I don't know, it sounds bad as much as I can say. Because I actually will say this, Ken, I think it's also reasonable to ask questions about when and why campaigns are surveilled. In other words, we want to be thoughtful and watch how governments are surveilling campaigns. But here, the conclusions and the rhetoric and all of it just is so outside of reality and unrelated to reality that none of these very legitimate questions are really being asked.
Absolutely.
So we have a couple questions from our listeners. Do you have another one, Patty?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this lit up your Twitter feed. No doubt. I think you're both aware of how interested people are in this conversation. One is, could the next administration charge Flynn for any of the criminal acts he acknowledged in his plea deal? For example, the statute of limitations has not expired. They want to know about that. The language of the plea deal and the actions of DOJ in their motion do not preclude charging withdrawn with or without prejudice.
So it's a little bit tricky. The plea agreement says that in exchange for him pleading, they will not prosecute him for the things covered in the statement of facts that's attached. The statement of facts talk about the lies. They do not go into in detail all the other violations that may not be out there. So I would expect if a future administration tried to prosecute him, he would take a shot. I would take a shot if I were his lawyer at arguing that the vagueness of the language and that since the statement of facts referred to the FARA violations, that they are precluded from being prosecuted, and that the promises in the plea agreement are still good because it was the Department of Justice that moved to dismiss. You know, even if he moved to withdraw his plea, he hadn't successfully done so. I think it would just be a mess. My sense is that ultimately he would not prevail in those arguments and that they would be able to prosecute him for pretty much whatever they wanted. But it would be very contentious and it would be an appellate issue.
Yeah. And on the appellate process, I think we had a question on that as well.
Oh, Patty. Absolutely. Is there any way with appeals and process that this drags on post-election?
I think that's up to Judge Sullivan. Judge Sullivan gets to decide when to hold hearings. He could hold a series of them. How long is he going to give his amicus judge to put in something? Is he going to have witnesses? Is he going to have briefing? And then how long is he going to take to decide? I don't think he would need to break a sweat to drag it out that long if that's what he wants to do.
Do you think, Ken, you know, so there's something called a writ of mandamus. Do you think that there's a chance that DOJ is going to try to use that tool to get a court of appeals to intervene?
That would be super aggressive, and you'd have to be extremely confident in the court of appeals to do that. And I don't think they have that level of confidence in that court. Because if he were just refusing to do it outright, that would be one thing. But if he's put a process in place and he's saying, in order to evaluate this and the claims in it, I want to go through this process, I think it's really hard for them to get away with that argument.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that what's very helpful for Judge Sullivan here is he's basically just saying, I want more information. I want to hear people's views. And it's just hard to see the other side of that. Like, you know, I mean, I, what is the downside, really? I mean, people are making it sound like this is some sort of, I've seen these suggestions that from the right that this is some sort of deep state interference or whatever. I don't really understand what's interfering about just making legal arguments that the judge can disregard if he wants to. What's the harm with him having more information? So I it's hard for me to see appellate judges siding against Judge Sullivan on that.
Well, to be fair, there are some fairly pro-Trump appellate judges, but I'm pretty confident that at least an en banc panel would put up with it.
I think that that's right. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us. This has been fantastic. Now, obviously, people can follow you on Twitter at Pope Hat. But, of course, you have your own podcast, which I have appeared on multiple times. I find very informative. Can you tell us a little bit about your podcast and where people can listen to that?
Well, thank you, Renato. I have two, actually. I have a weekly podcast with Josh Barrow, who's the host of Left, Right, and Center. It's called All the President's Lawyers. It's on KCRW. And every Wednesday, we talk about the president's latest legal machinations and people in the outer orbit of Trump lawyers like Michael Avenatti. My other podcast is called Make No Law, and it's about the history and background of famous First Amendment cases, and it's on Legal Talk Network.
That's fantastic. I assume you can listen to both of those podcasts wherever on your favorite podcast app.
Anywhere you can find them, yes.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Ken. I learned from you, and I really always enjoy your perspective. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Renato. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of On Topic. Please subscribe to this podcast. Go to your app and review the podcast and join us for our next episode. I'm Renato Mariotti. Until next time, let's stay on topic.